Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. My gosh. They're all going against the wind.
It was basically a cube with inside of sphere where the points of the cube were touching outside of the sphere.
So this isn't anything that just is limited to the United States. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to TUP Talks, episode 2. It's myself, Andy, and with me, as always, I have Dan, my co-host. Dan, how are we doing this evening?
I'm great, thank you, Andy. How are you?
I'm great. And I should really say, how are you doing this morning? How are you doing tonight? How are you doing this afternoon? Just in case someone's listening to this in the future at various, you know, varying times, and it makes their drive. Yeah, I'm covering the bases, so delete as applicable, folks, okay? but yeah, thank you, wherever you're listening around the world. TUP Talks episode 1, me and Dan were just discussing off air, had a ton of people listening to it, which is great, especially for a new show, where of course we are discussing Unidentified episode 3 and 4 on this show. Now that was UFOs and nukes and planetary threat. I think I made a mistake before in our show and called it interplanetary threats, which maybe made it even more exciting than it actually was, that there's multiple planets involved within this threat. So yeah, I totally missold on that one.
Would the show budget go to SpaceX in that case?
Elon Musk potentially getting involved, or God, he's a divisive character. I'm going to do a show on him eventually, I think, because yeah, he's very much the Tony Stark of, well, giving kids stupid names. But yeah, but Dan, when you saw the episode guide, because I remember that was one of the first things we talked about before Unidentified came out. I think episode 1, 2, and 3 had all leaked, or correct me if I'm wrong, but UFOs and Nukes jumped out at me straight away as a title.
Yeah, for sure. The episode titles have kind of been leaking as we've gone along up to the full reveal a week or so back. But yeah, UFOs and Nukes has been a long-running connection, right? And it's great to hear TCSA directly address that. For I was going to say an hour, but I guess 45 minutes advertising.
And it's interesting, episode 7 is Lou Elizondo doesn't believe in aliens, so that'll be an interesting episode. I'm just joking, that is definitely not what it's going to be called, but we are going to touch on episode 4, Planetary Threat, as well, and how the episode ended about Lou's own sighting, which we'll get to, of course. But episode 3, very intriguing. Episode 3, UFOs and Nukes. Overall thoughts on the episode, Dan?
I really enjoyed the episode. It was very, very lovely to see a very smartly dressed Tim McMillan in there as well. He does great work, and it's really fantastic to see him on screen there getting the credit he deserves.
I have to plug that, obviously, Tim McMillan I interviewed in episode 4 and 5. It was a two-parter in one of my very early interviews, where I think for one of the first times, Tim actually talks about the Department of Energy and their involvement and how he had FOIA'd them. And it's interesting that more and more we're hearing Department of Energy being mentioned as a bigger player in the whole UFO UAP scene than maybe was initially thought, and that's coming to the forefront. And again, Jeremy McGowan, who I'll talk about in a few minutes, when I interviewed him last night, or a couple of nights ago, an interview released last night, he also mentioned on the scene the Department of Energy were there as well, so the name's getting bandied about a lot. So that's something I've kind of noticed creeping into more and more articles and comments and news broadcasts as well.
Yeah, it has. There was news this week that I was just reading through an article that was talking about, atom-layered material similar to the bismuth magnesium that we're all familiar with. And then right at the bottom of the article, just tucked down there, was the Department of Energy has restarted their funding for the research. And it just made me think, going back, they could have had something. And the fact that restarting is in there, it made me think that it's something that, as many people say, was put on the shelf until they could deal with it. Scientifically, that is.
Yeah, it makes so much sense. If you've got a department that deals with all things energy for a country, if you have a potential new energy source or an exotic energy source that you're trying to understand, then that's the people who would have this. And they're a huge, powerful, section within the government, and no doubt private sectors, and I'm not too sure how it totally works over in the US. But yeah, it just made sense when Tim mentioned that to me, and it's interesting to see that come to the floor more and more. David Marceau, I love an artist's impression or a reconstruction or a render, and I like that we're seeing more of that in this series. Again, we're not getting all those, episode 4 actually, we do get some videos and pictures, which was nice. But episode 3, it's more reconstructions, but I like that little bit extra effort going into it. This is what these people saw, and you'll hear the testimony, but they're going to also show you a drawing of it, show you a recreation. And David Marceau discusses the object he saw as being quite a huge craft. And the artist's design, I thought, was quite interesting as well, that he said he saw. It wasn't necessarily your typical UFO you would expect to see. What was your thoughts on it, Dan?
Correct me if I'm wrong, that was the one that had the kind of the bright spot on the one side of it, right? Like it was kind of an exhaust.
Well, that's interesting. You think exhaust, whereas I thought window.
Yeah, window for sure. That could be it.
But I'm now thinking exhaust. But
I mean, that's just where my brain goes. Yeah, we've got to acknowledge that's just our bias. And
okay. But yeah, so for me, it was a huge craft, and that was something Lou talked about, the size of it, the geometry. Ryan Sprague did mention that he was really intrigued with that. I think you got in on that conversation on Twitter as well, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. Ryan was talking about it on Twitter, and since the material at the base was thought to be nuclear and it attracted the UFO or UAP, whichever is your preference, I asked if I possibly they'd used this same technique to attract and maybe communicate with the UFO. And Ryan responded to me with, "Have I got a story for you?" If you ever interview him, that's the story I'd like, please.
Yeah, Ryan's totally up for coming onto the podcast for an interview. Obviously, he's got his new book released as well, Somewhere in the Skies, second edition. Please go and check that out on Amazon. But yeah, I'm going to be speaking to Ryan. But yeah, I noticed that, but he left it there, didn't he? Because even I had said go on, and yeah, we've had nothing since on that. So yeah, potentially dummy UFOs and intercontinental ballistic missiles, as they are, they're also being kept. But it's intriguing that this such a big craft was there. A couple of soldiers saw it, but again, it just disappears, doesn't it? And this is where we're starting to get all this testimony leaking out.
Absolutely. I really like that there was a corroborating testimony for that one. Yes. I'm a big fan of, multiple points of view of the same event. And yeah, that did a lot to really drive that one home.
Yeah, I think Jeremy McGowan, who obviously there was a few different testimonies, but the one that stood out to me as well was Jeremy McGowan. So again, his episode is just released, talking to myself. And again, Dan, I liked, and again, thanks for all the feedback, folks. And Dan as well listens to these, and usually I give him like the previews beforehand to tell me what he thinks. Danny said he felt like it was a special feature for Unidentified, which I liked. But as Jeremy says, he spoke to Lou for around an hour and a half to 2 hours and in 6 to 8 minutes of content made it onto the show, just given time constraints and the testimony and everything else. So he expanded on the story. And for me, as I mentioned on the interview, it sounds like the plot of a 1990s Nicolas Cage movie. it's just very, you know, Broken Arrow. There's a recovered nuclear weapon or nuclear material out in the middle of the Jordanian desert. An elite task force is guarding it. And as he said himself, there's the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the DOD, the DOE, Department of Energy, of course, like I said, are all there. And he's told that basically they have to shoot anyone who goes near this crate. Now, that in itself was quite a fascinating story. And then you tie into it the fact, obviously, there's a UFO, UAP sighting involved as well. What was your thoughts on Jeremy's tale?
I absolutely loved it. It was riveting. I loved hearing him expand on it in your conversation. Like you said, it's almost a shame that he only gets to be on the show for 6 minutes. But having worked in production, I know that, you know, you film for an hour and use very little of what you film. It would be lovely to see those as actual unidentified special features one day, you know. But I understand the time constraints.
Yeah, I'm all for some bonus content if that's something they would ever look into doing. With Jeremy sighting, he mentioned on the show that the object was coming over his head, hitting a point in the sky, and then taking that, one of the five observables, easy for me to say,
that's right,
shooting off to on a totally different 90-degree angle. It keeps happening, but something that he said that he had never considered until Lou Elizondo asked him, for 25 years, as Jeremy told me after we stopped recording, but it's okay to share this, that he thought it was the same object, and it never occurred to him that this could have been multiple objects coming down and turning, whether it was some kind of, you know, interplanetary highway, or, you know, they're following a repeating pattern, or something's following something else, or maybe it was the same object and it was some kind of reconnaissance, who knows. But again, we've got nuclear weapon potentially out in the desert, as we kind of find out, it sounds like it pretty much was. All these different departments out there, and something's keeping an eye on it. On the whole UFOs and nukes, you know, connection, for me, Dan, and it's going to tie into the next episode as well when we get to it, but the threat narrative, that whether people like it or not, and this is something that's easy to get across on maybe this show that I struggle on Twitter, where I get why they are going with a narrative of these potentially being a threat. I'm not saying that we should blow these things up or shoot them. That is absolutely not what I'm saying. But I do understand where you have to consider the possibility that these things are turning these on and off for a reason. You know, especially when you don't know what's inside them. These could be drones, where they're turning up and basically showing that they can turn on and off missile silos. They can potentially blow missiles out the sky, as we've seen some, you know, kind of grainy but interesting YouTube videos. So if you've got, as a planet, another defense, you know, it's a ridiculous weapon to have, isn't it? It's the whole mad theory, mutually assured destruction, that someone launches one, someone else launches one, then, you know, they all die, so what's the point? But
yeah,
down the line, if these were something like Independence Day, let's go back to one of my favorite movies, they use a nuclear weapon against this alien race, that it does nothing because it literally hits a force field, right? But are these things potentially making the point? We can come into your backyard and we can play with all your toys if we want and you can do nothing about it. Or are they coming in and showing us that we shouldn't use these, or that if we do or choose to use them, this is how easily they can just turn them off, so there's no point? What's your thoughts on it, Dan? It's a big topic and one that probably deserves a whole show, but...
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's a long, rich history here, isn't there? But yeah, I'm with you. The question of whether it's a threat or not, for me, it's important to understand that that's a defensive question, not an offensive question. We're not asking that question because we want to attack them. Like, you know, if we find that we're superior, we're not just, or at least I hope we're not just going to go gung-ho to war with them. It's more a case of asking, are we safe? this is happening. Are we safe? And that's a totally reasonable question for me. You know, if I'm in an unfamiliar situation, that question, you know, it's so fundamental to being human and going about our day to day that you ask it without really thinking about it. Am I safe? You meet a new animal, or, you know, you see a dog in the park, you ask it. So why wouldn't we be asking that about this?
And you've got people in different camps within ufology, and you've got the Stephen Greer notion, not the charging $2,500 to watch flares being dropped off the coast. You know, I'm just joking that we don't.
Shots fired.
We don't know. Yeah, shots fired. We don't know that for sure. But, you know, you've got the narrative that they're all friendly and really happy, nice, you know, beings, entities. You've got other people that, you know, claim really brutal abductions. There's been claims of sexual assaults and, you know, hybrid beings, and I know that goes off way on a tangent, but there are a lot of reports that some of these experiences aren't particularly friendly, or at least they weren't willing participants. So
yeah,
I can definitely see, and then especially when it comes to a military point of view, at the end of the day, these militaries from all around the world have, it's a defence, as you say. It can be a weapon, but it's also a defence for various different reasons. And these objects are quite clearly displaying technologies and capabilities and sending a message in one way or another that we can just turn your best and most devastating weapons off with literally the flick of a button, the change of a frequency. And even to go back to series one, we had the incident in Italy with the fires, and
that's right,
they had traced a frequency back to the sea that had started fires within the village. And then we saw the incident with the helicopter where they're saying that it was targeted with a frequency beam, and a helicopter basically crash landed, but everyone was safe. So again, there's still an incident that it's still all unexplained. And like I said, it's hard. There's no solid proof or evidence. Well, unless you're Chris Mellon, who, as he says at the end of the title sequence, Carl Sagan once said, extraordinary claims required extraordinary proof. Well, we have that proof now. So if this is good enough for them, then I'm happy to go along with the threat narrative, because it is definitely opening doors, and it has done within a very short period of time. Some of the listener comments for episode 3 particularly, we had Bo, who said there was not enough Chris Mellon in this one, so obviously a Chris Mellon fan, but still respect all the witnesses coming forward for the first time. And absolutely, anyone who's appearing in this series, you've got to appreciate what they're doing coming forward, because these people have nothing to gain from this. Your Jeremy McGibbons, David Marceau's, all those former or ex-military are still usually either tied in with defence contracts now, or private sector, or, you know, have a lot of friends and colleagues and brothers, as they would call them, from a military background, that no doubt there's a stigma still attached to it. But hopefully, with them seeing this type of show, more and more of them come forward.
Yeah, absolutely. There was, I don't know if you saw the Wall Street Journal article this week, but it was damning, but it was like a little time capsule of a bygone era. I hadn't quite realized how much things had moved on since that kind of attitude. You know, it used to be that 100% of articles were like that, but now that's one out of, what, 60, 70 we've had in the past few weeks. It's glorious.
We were talking about that last night, weren't we? We had a bit of a Skype conversation, one of the few we've not recorded. but yeah, that was it. That if we look in isolation, and this was some of the points I've been making, that should we put a bit of a pin in it, in the 70 plus years of UFO research and history and all the good that's been done, and decide that we have to take this new direction forward that we've gone in the last 2.5 years, to start looking at things in a different way, because it seems to be getting results. And that might upset a lot of people, but I'm just saying there's a lot of potential that maybe it's time for different theories, different approaches. Lou Elizondo is no doubt the head of the movement, whether people like it or not. And when you look at your Stanton Friedmans, your J. Allen Hynek's, Elizondo's probably now up in that echelon, isn't he?
Yeah, for sure. This is going to be in the history books. There's no doubt.
But it's on the History Channel, so it's no doubt going to end up in history books as well. So yeah. Craig mentioned it was one of the better episodes. He likes to keep going over the case, so even people who have difficulty understanding will get it when this breaks open, because they are making the same points over and over and over again, but it's that weight of testimony. One case and one soldier, one pilot coming forward isn't going to land the message that they have to. But 25 or 26 different testimonies make it into this entire series. As Anthony Lippe told me, that's a lot.
It's overwhelming, isn't it?
Well, was it 2,500 contacts that he had? They said he had to go through to whittle it down and whittle it down. So, and I keep going back to the fact that he told us on that interview that people from NASA had got in touch but didn't want to commit to going on the record with experiences. Right. And that's a tease.
Like season three now.
Yeah, that's a whole different series altogether, I think. The secret agent said, I enjoyed the spooky, weird sub-narrative with the box in the desert story. I think it's the first time we've seen one of the TTSA members mention that we are not alone, from Luis Elizondo, and also Harry Reid is a big step in the series for me. Another great episode.
Harry Reid was great. There was that great quote where he said, like, he's always believed there are other beings out there. I really hope that I'm not misattributing this now. I've always believed there are other beings out there. It's not devils and goblins, it's science.
I think if you get it wrong, get in touch and he'll make you change your quote anyway.
I'll do a retraction.
Yeah, he'll come out and deny it.
I'll change something else and the Black Vault can enjoy it.
Yeah. Jack said it was awesome. I'm only halfway through. Brian Miller, I like this, and we'll discuss this. I got the impression that someone is maybe going to help protect us from nuclear war. What's your thoughts on that? That's quite a common theory, isn't it? That if we did start to launch these against each other, then would any kind of beings or entities interfere?
I don't think so. Not because I'm pessimistic, only because I believe that there have been provocations over the past, 60, 70 years that have been tests for us. And to put the decision in our hands, I think they'd rather kind of do a Star Trek Prime directive and be hands off and let us make the right choice, as opposed to doing it for us and just having to deal with it over and over and over again, you know?
Yeah, I made the point to someone, and I can't remember if it was on a show. Actually, I think it's with Richard Lenny, who I interviewed, and the interview will be coming out probably sometime next week now. What about Hiroshima and Nagasaki where... two devastating nuclear events, but given they were among the first that we know of, is there an element of, okay, let the kids burn themselves once and then we'll take the matches off them? Or
possibly.
Is it a case of, do you know what, then if you're going to do it, you're going to do it, then, crack on?
Yeah, I mean, at a certain point, you've got to let people be who they are and let the chips fall where they may, right? But you're right. That's a really interesting thought, that Hiroshima and Nagasaki would have been a possible look and see the destruction that you've caused.
Absolutely.
Don't do it again, or we hope you don't do it again, rather.
Yep, so here's a crashed UFO in Roswell for you to play with and maybe take a few technological leaps forward,
I've always wondered, little bit of speculation, but I've always wondered if the nuclear weapons, if we're talking interdimensional, if it would have had an effect on those other dimensions. That's speculation.
Crack open a doorway, or they have a bit of a ripple, or
it could be a really bad event on their side. We just don't know. So, it's a very powerful release of energy.
I love an analogy, or like bringing like a movie reference in. Okay, have you seen Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse?
I have. That's a great film.
Yeah. So, at the start, when the Kingpin turns on the big machine and it rips open the realities, and all the other Spider-Men, Spider-Pig, Spider-Gwen, Spider-Noir all come
in. That's perfect.
That maybe what it's kind of, that little bang, that moment, those atoms, splitting, interacting, boom, and then these things start to come in. Who knows? A few more thoughts on episode 3. It was good. It was stellar. I've been watching every episode. The work Malin and Elizondo are doing now is vital to moving forward. More DOD and DOE information should come out through FOIA. And I loved it. More evidence from people with solid backgrounds, captivating stories. Can't wait for the next episode. That was UAP Curious, Render, and Cosmic Pluralism Studies as well. Thank you for the difficult names to pronounce in a Scottish accent, folks. Why can't I just have, like, Alan or Sharon? You know, that would be great. But no, thank you for everyone sending in thoughts on that. Episode 3, overall, when I put out a Twitter poll on the first 4 episodes, came out massively in front of what's been the best episode so far.
Really?
Yeah. Are you more of a episode 4 fan, Dan?
I am, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know what I think? I think with Dan, though, I think Dan goes with what the last episode was is going to be his favourite.
That's exactly right.
As we go
yeah.
forward. Oh, episode 5 blew 4 out the water, and episode 6. Episode 6, that was 45 minutes of static. Dan just loved what they'd done and the direction they went in on there. Maybe in one of these upcoming episodes, on the end of the series, someone will be wearing some of Dan's stuff and that'll just take total precedent for him.
I died.
Yeah, Dan almost died when he saw Sean Cahill sitting wearing his own branded, which if you check out Dan's Redbubble store, which again will be in the links, he's very cool badge and decal sticker is there as well, and it's on a lot of different clothing. So Sean Cahill's been repping that, and TTSA's Instagram's got it on it, their Twitter feed's got it on it, yeah. And I'm sure Lou Elizondo's got like a massive order in for some stuff coming up soon. That last part may or may not be true.
Have one on the back of his truck.
Have you heard rumors? I say rumors. I know your sources, Dan, and I would believe that is very much a fact. If it's, I'm jealous. So, folks. Anyway, as me and Dan digress, episode 4, planetary threat. So again, Dan, you see that heading, planetary threat. What's your thoughts?
It's important to realise there's a question mark after it. In the episode listings, none of them have the question mark. So going into the episode, I thought they were about to make the statement, whereas it was more of an exploration of why it should be considered a planetary threat.
Yeah, do you know what? I missed the question mark. That's very Anchorman Ron Burgundy. Whatever you put on the teleprompter, he'll read. And it totally changes the meaning of it, though, from planetary threat to planetary threat, if you've got that inflection in the voice. So, yeah, I actually have totally missed the question mark, which is a massive deal, and maybe a lot of other people did as well, actually. So, for me, I love when they go around different countries. Something that was hinted to me from Anthony Lippe was that South America would play a big part, and boy, Lou got the Amex out for his travels around South America. We had Peru, Chile, Argentina, and you cannot help be impressed, especially if you're a Lou Elizondo fan, that he just slips in and out of various different languages and dialects with absolutely no effort whatsoever, which I like. But yeah, what was your kind of impressions then on your favourite episode so far, Dan?
It's great to see some cases from outside the USA. I know we had Randall Chum in the first season, but it's nice that we get a few here. And we also hear about the investigations going back many, many years, one of which seemed to be very controversial, judging by Lou's reaction.
Which one was that?
That was the one in Uruguay. I think it was Captain Marcus Tomasio. Apologies on the pronunciation. But basically, the program was formed in 1979 at the behest of the USA after the USA had just closed Blue Book, which yes. is kind of wild.
Yeah, so I was going to bring that up too. Lou seemed a little bit taken aback by that, didn't he? That, huh,
he did.
So you were instructed by the US government or in collaboration with them at their behest, I believe was one of his words, to... Yeah. form this program and study this phenomena, which again ties in with, let's go back to episode 1, these have been happening for decades upon decades upon decades, and now we're finding out other governments have had programs going back decades and decades. So they're tying it in, they're weaving a thread throughout this for people to plot the points on. But yeah,
and it was a little surprising after, you know, the first season, people would say that TTSA were focusing too much on the modern stuff. So it's really great to see that they're branching out into that history and we're not forgetting the past.
Yeah. Was it when he goes to Argentina and he meets the head of the program there, where the guy, I don't know if Dan, you want to be the Jamie of the show, you said, if you can grab his you can grab his name for us. But he was he's had 100% success rate in closing the cases. Was that in Argentina? It wasn't Peru, was it?
That was Ruben Lianza, official UFO investigations agency in Buenos Aires, I think.
Yeah, so there we go. It was Argentina, yeah.
He explained the rocket launch one, didn't he? And that was fairly compelling, you know, with the kind of the glow with the color underneath. But it didn't match the whole story that the pilots were suggesting. So Lou had that great quote where he said, "I believe he's closed them all, but I don't believe he's solved them all."
Yeah, he's basically Argentina's Mick West, for anyone who's not seen the episode yet. No, I'm going to listen and look at this fact, which fits my own narrative, and I will not listen to any of the corroborating evidence or the alternative angles.
I wonder if his salary is related to closing cases.
Ooh, shots fired, as you said earlier. I didn't like him. I don't think Lou liked him. Lou
they
has
didn't
an incredible,
seem to get on very well, did
yeah,
they?
He's got an incredible poker face, doesn't he? And when that guy was sitting there quite smarmy and given the whole, well, yes, they're almost all misconceptions, or they're this or they're that. And they're showing these videos of, you know, the orbs. And this is something where I don't get too deep into the conversation because I don't have a background in any kind of imagery analysis, or I take things at face value. And if I see a video on my Twitter just an hour ago, I retweet a video of what looks like an orange orb being captured in the daytime. And here's a fact for everyone about me: I'm colorblind. So if I've said orange and it's yellow, you know, don't start trolling me. Was it right? Cool. Yeah. So, I might get those wrong from time to time with my colours. But yeah, so it looks pretty good though at face value, the footage. And I'll look at it and go, does it disappear when it shouldn't behind branches? Or, you know, if someone, does it look doctored in any way? Does it? And, you know, you can tell when something looks fake. But now we've got the problem that things can look too good. So you really can't win with any footage. A lot of the pictures of orbs or these people claim they're celestial beings, or they're kind of drones, or they're kind of just balls of light in the sky that these pilots are seeing and corroborating and testifying about, they seem quite confident that they know what a star looks like, they know what a satellite looks like, they know what auroras look like, and they are trained observers because part of their skill set has to be with a naked eye that they can fly these incredible, you know, craft. And I don't mean UFOs, I mean the actual planes that they fly with no instruments barely, you know, if they have any malfunction. So these guys know what they're looking at. And obviously one of the pilots pulls out his phone and shows Lou the video he took and the picture he took.
That's right.
And Lou's captivated. Now, it seems to me that it's too easy for someone like an Argentinian Mick West or a, you know, British Mick West to just call out that, oh yeah, it's just a star out of focus. Do you not think they would have checked that? And do you not think this guy knows what a star looks like, and that's why he doesn't every single night he flies on the red eye in Argentina or Peru take his phone out and record stars?
Yeah, absolutely. They'd have experience knowing what they were looking at, right? It's ridiculous that anyone suggested that, you know, what David Fravor saw was a canopy reflection. Just absurd. I think D.D. Johnson sums it up well when he says it's kind of the opposite of Occam's razor. Instead of the simplest solution kind of usually being right, it's kind of the need of a comedy of errors to justify something so outlandish to make this a possibility that it's just useless, basically.
Yeah, and I have no issue with debunking anything because I like facts. sets, and I do enjoy looking at some incredible footage, and there's certain ones I look at and think, my God, that probably looks too good. But then I know there's a video that always creeps about online of, it's meant to be UFO has landed in the middle of a forest, and it's someone from a distance. If you've ever seen this one, you probably will have. And it shows you little beings out of focus walking up the ramp, and then the UFO taking off, and you can clearly see it's CGI'd. You can just tell, but then there's so much else. Like the most recent, it was quite a recent video of the three large tic-tac-looking objects coming round the moon.
That's right, yeah.
Now, I can't remember. I'd seen people saying that was fake and it was CGI'd, and had that been confirmed?
I don't think a source was found on it, but it got to the point where it was pretty definitive that it was CGI because of the sizing of the shadows to the objects and how far they were from the moon, so on and so forth. Like the shadows would have been more diffused or something like that. People smarter than me figured it out.
It's a prime example of that looked really, really good at first.
Yeah,
glass.
For sure. It looked really good. And there's one thing that always, always comes up, and it makes me laugh because it's a video of ball lightning. And, you know, that kind of gets blamed for UFO stuff a lot. Mm-hmm. And as far as I can tell, there are no videos of it online. And there's one video that always comes up that's kind of a blue blob of ball lightning going across some train tracks. And the sparks are kind of flying off it like, you know, Electro in Spider-Man as he mm-hmm. walks along. Yeah. And it's a fake video, but it looks fantastic. You know, there's reflections on the tracks, everything like that. I'm really looking forward to TTSA and SkyHub starting to make software that can pin down these videos within seconds. You know, it's going to take a while to kind of get those parameters, but it'll be great to be able to just chuck it through and go, hey, that's a fake.
Absolutely. And one of the listeners of the show, long-time listener Mark, he has commented on episode 4 that why do we think Lou wouldn't elaborate on his own sighting? He's got his own theory, which he hasn't shared, but what do we think? So Dan, obviously, the episode ends with the producer or one of the producers asking Lou, you've had your own sighting, and it's very matter of fact. So they've obviously had a discussion. You know, what do you think? Why haven't you shared it? Lou doesn't really, he gives the sigh and the look away, almost a Skinwalker Ranch-esque moment, if we want to talk about production. It came across a tiny bit, not rehearsed, but, you know, that was planned. And it's been put there for a reason. But
possibly
I will absolutely let him away with
question.
It.
The second question really surprised me. The producer asks, I'm paraphrasing now, but is it what do you believe they are? And, oh no, do you believe they're real? That's it, sorry. And he kind of shifts awkwardly and says, with all due respect, I'm not going to answer that question. And he looks very emotional when he says it. It's the first time I've kind of seen that the cool of Luis Elizondo fall away for a second. So I think that first question possibly could have been asked a number of times, and that's why it's coming across as something that maybe feels sage to you. But yeah, that second answer was wild.
I'll always be fair. Why did Luis Elizondo not just answer yes to that final question, given what he's talked about, and, you know, on CNN, Fox, all those different news networks that he's been on, and the whole nature of the show, why didn't he just answer yes, in your opinion?
Do you mean to the do you believe they're real question?
Yeah.
I think purely because the word believe is in there. Luis Elizondo doesn't seem to deal with belief. I should put that on a t-shirt.
You should.
Deal with belief. But yeah, I that was my impression, that it just came down to that. It's not to do with belief, the Bill Nunn watertight case with evidence, and I think he just wants to keep it like that.
Fair enough. Yeah, I mean, he clearly knows these things are real, and he has a good idea, I think, of what they may be, or what multitudes of these may be, given they're probably more than one thing, as we're kind of looking at and trying to find out. But yeah, episode 4 as a whole, really enjoyed it. Enjoyed the traveling around different parts of South America. Something I spoke with Buddy from Alien Protocols about was, like, you know, ET Superhighway over South America. We had the Maje UFO incident a few months ago as well. And again, it just seems to be one of those continents particularly, and there's so many countries where UFO and UAPs are just part of the culture. This happens a lot. They see these things a lot. It's not a surprise, and it gets reported in the news over there a lot better than it does in the US, and then as we know, particularly in the UK as well. So really enjoyed episode 4. So yeah, pretty much that's us done for this week. Episodes 5 and 6 of Unidentified. Episode 5 will be the 8th of August at 9:10 Central, and episode 6 will be the 15th of August again, 9:10 Central. Episode 5, Airline Encounters. It does what it says on the tin. If you're a Ron Sill, Quick Drying Woodstain fan, some older UK listeners might appreciate that reference. And episode 6, interestingly, the UFO cover-up.
That's going to be a good one, I think. I can feel it in my bones. I've always kind of maintained to friends of mine that I can't prove to them that aliens are here, but I can prove to them there's been a cover-up. There is so much paperwork. There is so much kind of mysterious circumstances around certain things. There's so much playing with intelligence and conducting operations on people and things like that, that I'm really excited to see what they include. There's a lot that could be in there.
Yeah, really excited for those. And then that's us halfway through this series already, and then we've got to wait however long for another series of Unidentified. Devastating stuff.
It's going fast, hasn't it?
It is. It's nice doing it as it kind of happens as well. So listen, folks, this episode will more than likely drop this coming Friday. There's not much point in me saying that at this point, actually, because you're listening to it and it's going to be at least Friday. So, yeah, totally irrelevant. And I'm not editing that out because, yeah, that just shows the stupidity of what I've just said, really, doesn't it? So this episode has aired because you are listening to it. I hope you enjoyed it. You've made it to the end. Thank you very much. Again, Dan, thank you for your time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, as always.
Awesome. And again, folks, keep looking up. You never know what you might see.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th. So get your tickets now at kosai.org.